One of the things that I think determines so much of our defines so much of our religious world today is a presumption of autonomy and a presumption of you getting to kind of, you know, strike out your own path and define what your religious world should be. And that is, at least on a surface level, in stark contrast to the way the entire system of Torah, mitzvot, and halakha work. And I want to kind of draw out a little bit of those assumptions, like start from the place of the problem or the contradiction as like obviously articulated, but then look at some maybe anomalies, maybe features in the system of Torah and mitzvot that I don't think undermine the basic structure of things, but perhaps carve out a little more space for thinking about how people might create a little bit of their own religious world, and at least see some sources that are grappling with the limits of that. Starting with a passage we could spend the whole time on, but I really just want to use as a reference point, which is this passage in Dvarim, chapter 29, which is the Brit in Arvot Moav. It's Moshe at the end of the journey, at the end of his life, kind of summing up really everything about Sefer Dvarim, all the mitzvot that have been laid out there. And he lays out an image of the Brit, which if you look at this passage, has three central components, none of which I think should be taken for granted. So the first here, Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem lifnei Adonai Eloheichem, Rashechem, Shivtechem, Zikneichem, Veshotreichem, Kol Ish Yisrael, Tabchem, Neshechem, Vegercha, Asher Bekerv Machaneecha, Mechotev, Etzecha, Ad Shoev Memecha, Lo Brecha, Bibrit Hashem Elokecha. All of you are standing here today, says Moshe, and then you get a list of people whose entire function is basically to disabuse you of the notion that anyone is not in the Brit. Right? In other words, it is a vision of a comprehensive covenant with everyone present. Oh, you think it's only with the leaders? No, it's Kol Ish Yisrael. It's actually every single person. Oh, you think it's only with the men, the adult men? No, it's with the children, with the women. You think it's only with Israelites? The ger also, who's not Israelite, but resident with you. You think it's economically stratified? No, every profession. Okay, so that's piece one. The notion that you have a community where everyone is invited into, expected as part of the Brit. That's what I'm calling comprehensive. The next piece is a few psukim later. V'lo itchem levadchem anochi koreit et ha-brit hazot ve'et ha'ala hazot ki et asher yeshno po imanu omer hayom lifnei Adonai Eloheinu ve'et asher einenu po imanu hayom. Lest you think the Brit is only being set up with the people who are here today, it's also being set up with those who are not here. Certainly the way this is understood, but I think it's also the pshat. It's the unborn, it's the future generations. It's the people who are not there, as it were, to assent to it. Okay? So comprehensive is not self-evident. You can have a covenant with like an elect group of people. And transgenerational is not self-evident. You could totally imagine that like every group has to re-ratify the terms of it. It's not unique, right? Like the U.S. Constitution is a comprehensive transgenerational covenant in that way. It's not like each generation gets to decide, we don't want to ratify the Second Amendment, so that's it, it doesn't apply. Maybe to some people's chagrin, but that's not the way it works. And for the first as well. So that's another feature here. And of course, that's something we take for granted, but don't always examine. The idea that most Jews are obligated in the mitzvot because they were born obligated in the mitzvot. Most Jews are in the covenant because they were born into the covenant, not because they chose it, not because they had the right to opt in or out. And I'll just take us then to the last piece, which is the most important, that it is a heteronomous covenant. It is the exact anti-definition of autonomy. Maybe there'll be someone might be someone who will say, you know, actually, I'd rather worship the other gods. And when hearing all of the penalties and oaths associated with this covenant, he'd barech bilvavole mor shalom yeli, ki b'shirut li bi'elef. It's fine. Okay, very nice. I don't want it. I want to do my own thing. And not in light terms, lo yoveh Hashem sloach lo, v'vilo Hashem l'ra'a mikol shiftei Yisrael. That person will not be forgiven. They will be separated out for punishment and consequence. And putting aside the whole language of punishment and consequence, the ground point here is that it's not up to you. You don't get to decide. You're like, well, I don't find it meaningful to do it. Too bad! From the perspective of the Torah, okay, I'm not speaking here in first person. I'm just narrating. Like, from the perspective of the Torah, in this passage, that's just not relevant, okay? When we look at the description of the Brit, it is something that applies to everyone across all the generations without any space for autonomy. All right, that's the basic frame. We're going to spend the rest of the time like poking at that and complicating it, but that's a departure. Yeah.
Just a quick question about the generation piece. Are you looking at previous generations as part of those who are not here right now or as those who still are here right now?
Previous generations to them. To them, I think it more or less starts here. We could argue, does it go to Ma'amad Har Sinai? Does it maybe go back to Avraham? I mean, you can say that family is in some way. But the mitzvot, right, it seems like they're being entered into Hayom, this Brit. And I think, like, from a traditional rabbinic perspective, you would say this is the Brit in our Got Moav, which has a bunch of things that are perhaps supplemental to the Brit at Sinai. And from here, going forward, that's the model. Everyone going forward, I'm not sure they're really thinking about what's before. Yeah.
I'm not sure how much to make of this, but it does seem like the use of the language of division, hivdilo Hashem l'ra'a, like, there is not like, yeah, you can leave if you want. If you want, I will give you that, and it will be very bad for you. It's not the same as saying, sure, you can secede and, you know, shalom will be yours, but
it could be that the act of autonomy perceived as, you know, rejection and rebellion is possible. To use like halachic language, it could be the kiddushin are tofsin, even if they're ba'avera, right? In other words, there are legal acts that can be forbidden, but nonetheless, like, have consequences. Sure, could potentially become an apostate where there's real consequences here written out. But you definitely don't have autonomy to do it, granted by the system. Okay, that's, I think, the main thing I'm interested in. But yes, it doesn't mean it's impossible to separate.
It might be a little bit less insistent than the rabbinic understanding, which is like, actually, you cannot do anything to stop being a Jew. Mm-hmm. Even if you're a mumar, that means a lot of disabilities, but you're still a Jew. This sort of makes it like, yeah, you can cut yourself out of the Shivtei Yisrael and it will suck, but at the end of the day, you won't be.
Yes. And I think the broader rabbinic record also reveals that there are meaningful positions that thought that too. But that's a whole other story. Okay. All right. But now let's look. All right. Because actually, I want us to take seriously, right, a whole other part of the Torah that we don't necessarily think about that much, which is the whole area of Nidarim and Nazir. Two whole masechtot in the Mishnah. Let's just take the version of this in Bemidbar. Ish ki yidor neder l'Hashem o yishava shvuel esor yisrael nafsho lo yachad barok echol yotze mipiv yaseh. The rest of that chapter is dealing with basically all the gender variations of this, which are actually not, according to the Torah, intrinsically gendered. They are about, or they're at least not, they're not intrinsically biologically determined, but they are determined by various hierarchies in a patriarchal society when women are married to men or betrothed to them or under their father. We're not engaging in that. We're just taking here the base case of basically someone who is not attached in some way that interferes with their ability to execute their autonomy vis-a-vis vows. And actually, the rule is very simple, which is if you take on in the name of God that you are going to do something, you are obligated to do that, okay? And here I just want to pause for a minute, and you can see from my title here of putting it as the power to impose our own values. This is something that cannot and should not be taken for granted. Sure, people might take vows and commit to do things. The Torah did not have to decide to make the fulfillment of your self-authored commitments one of its mitzvot. There's actually something very striking about that, if you stop for a minute. The Torah here says, if you take a vow to become a vegetarian, with whatever parameters you need, right, to make it count. But if you take a vow like that, God actually insists that you follow up on it. That becomes important to the Torah. The Torah has built into its system of expectation one rubric that is, it's sort of like, here are all the things that are important to me, and one of the other things that's important to me is what's important to you. Okay? Like, that's actually what a neder is, if you stare it in the face. Okay?
As long as you don't go against...
Oh, well, harder. Come on. That's the rest of the shir.
What contract law is, you know, in law, in legal ways. Two people agree on something, they sign it, and according to the constitution and the whole system, it's fine.
Correct. So what does the state care if we do this or not? So there you can say, right, well, the state cares about people upholding their word, because otherwise the whole society falls apart. But what's striking there is, so that's Ben Adam L'Chavero. It's actually very clear what falls apart if people can't trust each other. But this is Ben Adam L'Makom, right? In other words, these are things we're actually, certainly includes, it actually seems primarily focused on. Like, I decide I have to bring a certain sacrifice on a given day, which no one commanded me, but I decided that's very important to me, right? Suddenly, the Torah steps in and says that matters. Now, a neder may actually be limited to that, to actually gifts, to the, right, nedarai l'ashem ha-shalem, negdana l'cholam, oh, that seems like it's in a temple context, right? But the nazir is a kind of different package deal, which is a whole thing of someone taking on various restrictions that are meant to imbue them with certain holiness. And the most surprising one is Vayikra He. O nefesh ki tishava levatei bisvatayim lehara uleitiv. Lechol asher yivatei ha'adam bishvua v'ne'elam mimenu hu yada v'ashem la'achat me'el. So let's say someone takes on by oath, expressing with their lips, lehara uleitiv. Now the plain sense of lehara uleitiv is that's what's called a merism. You take two extremes, and it's meant to say everything in the middle, right? La'ra u'leitiv, right? Hishamer lecha pen tedaber im Yaakov mitov adra, says God to Lavan b'chalom halayla. Don't speak good or bad to Yaakov, which basically means don't you talk to him. Don't you open your mouth, right? And say anything to him. You know, b'nechem asher lo yadu tov vara, might be a euphemism for sexual awareness and maturity, as sometimes people read with Eitz Hadaat. But Asher Le'adu Tov V'ra probably means who knows nothing. Your kids who know nothing. So La'ra U'leitiv is probably an extreme way of saying, if you take an oath for whatever, L'chol Asher Yivatei Adam Bishvua, literally anything that you take on as a commitment, I swear I'm going to do X, and it slips your mind and you forget that you took that oath and you either don't act or you act, whatever it is, in contradiction to what you took on. And then you realize it and are ashamed and you bear guilt. I can't believe that. Well, then you're going to have to bring a whole korban. You'll have to bring a whole sacrifice. Okay? So here, very strikingly, this is not about a neder. This is not about bringing a gift or anything like that, or more to the point, you can't just constrict it to being about that. This is what Chazal will refer to as a shvuat bitui, an oath that you take that expresses some commitment that you are taking on. God holds you to that. Okay? So I want to pause there before we get to like resolving the interference that potentially arises. This is also, if I was saying it's not self-evident that a covenant would be, you know, comprehensive with everyone, it's not self-evident to be transgenerational, it's not self-evident that you have no autonomy, it's also not at all self-evident that the Torah itself would care about the things that you take on. And to the extent that we get into situations where having this in the system creates problems, which we'll get to. It's a kind of bizarre, unforced error. Okay? Like the Torah did not have to open up and create this space and make it one of the 613 mitzvot. And that's where I would double down on what I think is the significant sort of religious and theological point, which is that you can only understand that, and I think we'll only understand some of the sources we'll see later, as a manifestation of, yeah, God actually, we'll get to the limits later, but God and the Torah actually care about our ability to articulate our own values and strivings and actually hold us accountable to living up to what we say we're going to do in that regard. So literally, if I take, and here's the other thing you have to understand in terms of consequence. Because here, like you bring an asham offering, you bring a sacrifice into the temple, like the Kohanim are getting involved. And that can happen because I took an oath that I was going to go to the gym 3 times a week, and I didn't. That becomes a mitzvah d'oraita. I'm not saying anything controversial. This is just how, just what the Torah is saying. It's the way it's always been understood in rabbinic law. Literally, you take that kind of oath. And again, we're putting aside, what's our culture of oaths? Do we not like oaths? Do we dissuade people? That's a whole other separate issue, right? But fundamentally, our system says, if you have determined that actually it's important for you to go to the gym 3 times a week to the level you're going to take an oath and swear by God's name that you're going to do that, that matters. We don't just say, you shouldn't have done that. You get malkot for being over lotisa. Took God's name in vain, that was wrong, we punish you. That's the way you would behave if you would say, we can't just let people take God's name in vain. Then you would beat them if they do it inappropriately, right? You wouldn't say, oh, well then you have to go to the gym 3 times a week. But that's actually what this element of the Torah kind of demands of us. Right? Yeah.
Do you think that it's the mere fact that you brought God's name into it, which is the deciding factor, which is not just that that is the legal mechanism which makes it different, but God is concerned, we know in lots of places in Tanakh, with the divine reputation and
right.
not being associated with lies and things that are bad.
Yeah, so it could be, in the Neder and Nazir sources at the beginning, when it's Ki Yidor Neder Lashem and Ki Afli Lindor Neder Nazir Lahazir Lashem, that's more plausible. That is absent from Vayikra He, unless you bake it into the word Shavua, right? Which you can, right? And that's possible. And again, those may be some of the parameters. I would say, so first of all, I'm skeptical that's the only thing going on. But even if we posit that it is, right, there is still something striking about the fact that but the end result is what you're expected to do is to follow up on a whole bunch of things. And there is no sense, okay, you'll get in Kohelet, Tov asher lo tidor, misha tidor velo teshalem. We don't want unfulfilled vows, but it is a much later development, the notion that, you know, you shouldn't take a vow at all. Like even in Kohelet, kasher shvua yare, like the notion that someone who's afraid of a vow is somehow more pious, it seems wrapped up with non-compliance, right? Not that the thing itself is an issue.
But in Kohelet, it doesn't say, it's already saying, like, shut up.
So I don't know. I'm not sure that's... I think we're reading that a little bit through Kohelet. Like, hey, this is a big deal.
Correct.
Right? Now, understand, you can say it's a big deal because we don't want people to go back on their word, right? And by the way, it could be not just God. It could just be about fulfilling your word. I don't know. It doesn't totally add up to me in terms of the asham and the other elements and all of it. But you can think about that. That's food for thought. All right, so now let's read the Sifra. O yachol hanishba la'avor al hamitzvah yehei chayav. Just building off of the fact that the Torah has established that if you take an oath to do something, you have to do it. If I take an oath, I will eat a piece of salmon today, so then you must do it. okay? Even if you already had it last night. But could it be, ask the Midrash, what if I use this subheading, this subsection of the code in the Torah to commit myself to violating a mitzvah? So they already know that can't be. This can't be that the Torah is provided for the seeds of its own destruction from within. So how do I learn that? Talmud Torah, Talmud Lamar, lehara uleheitiv. Undermining the merism argument, not reading it as anything, but lehara, o leheitiv. Those are the two categories that you're allowed to do. Ma hatava reshut, af hara'a reshut, yatsa nishvar lavor al hamitzvah. So just as doing something that is good and positive will always be a davar harishut, something that is part of how a person is permitted to act in the world, the only forms of lehara are things that are also reshut. It can't be that you can take an oath that will bind you to do something that the Torah elsewhere has told you is destructive and forbidden. Okay? So you can say lehara, you know, I'm not going to sleep for 36 hours. And that becomes binding. Because at the end of the day, sleep is not a mitzvah outlined in the Torah. But the second you trespass on part of the specified part of the Torah, that's out. Okay, next. Otsi et hanishba la'avor al hamitzvah, velo otsi et hanishba lekayem et hamitzvah. So, okay, I get it. I can't take a vow to eat pig and have that have any effect. Okay, to be clear, it's like you make a vow like that, clause one indicates that you're not culpable for that. That just doesn't, it's not chal, it does not take effect. Okay? But what about if I take an oath to build a sukkah? To sit in a sukkah. Okay? To eat matzah at the Seder. What if I take an oath to do that? And why is that significant? Well, what happens in rabbinic, you know, culpability structures? What happens if I don't eat matzah at the Seder?
No, no? Over on positive.
That's right. Korban Pesach would be kar. If I don't eat matzah at the Seder, what's the consequence? Nothing. It's a bitul aseh. You shouldn't have done it. Maybe you feel bad, you'll offer a korban olah, but like, there's no consequence for failing to perform a mitzvah. You didn't break the rules. You just failed to do something, okay? It might be terrible for your relationship with God, but just in terms of consequences, there's no consequences. Whereas if I take a shvuat bitui to eat matzah, and then I don't eat matzah, I've now violated a negative commandment, and I have to bring a korban, a sacrifice. So actually, even psychologically, you can imagine someone who's feeling weak in their performance of mitzvot, potentially saying, I'm going to take an oath to do these things, to double down my obligation and raise the consequences, right? So this midrash is now asking, what we said, taking an oath to violate something in the Torah doesn't take hold. Is that also true of taking an oath to double down? Shehaya badin, sheyehe chayav. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. Because according to Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, actually, it's totally logical that such an oath should take effect. And here's his articulation. Ma Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. Ma im harishut she'ein mushba aleha mehar Sinai, harehu chayav aleha, mitzvah she'hu mushba aleha mehar Sinai, eino din she'yehe chayav aleha. So what does he play with? He actually plays with this whole model of covenant that we began with. The mitzvot in the Torah, any Jew born today has already been adjured to fulfill all of those mitzvot since Har Sinai. Why? Because it covered everyone, and it goes through the generations, and you have no autonomy. So therefore, you're born into that, okay? But what did we say that the Torah does hold you accountable for? Completely optional stuff. You make an oath about going to the gym. The Torah says, it's a mitzvah d'oraita. You must now go to the gym. and fulfill that oath. If something that has no backing whatsoever of God, the covenant, Torah, anything, you can become obligated for, so certainly something where there's already an obligation, you should be able to become, as it were, more obligated in or more culpable for. That was Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira actually thought that if you take an oath to eat matzah at the Seder, it upgrades. Amrulo, imamarta bishvuat arashut, shakein asa lav kehein, tomar bishvuat mitzvah, shalo asa balav kehein. No, you can't say that. Why? Because actually, you can't just do a kal vachomer of building up the scale of, this is optional, the oath takes effect. This is obligatory, of course the oath takes effect. Actually, these are two completely different modes that are not analogous. Optional activities are one where I could say, I promise I will go to the gym 3 times a week. Or I could also promise that I will not go to the gym 3 times a week this week. And both of those are things the Torah can countenance, maybe not advise, but countenance. And therefore, we can allow either direction to take effect. But since the Torah cannot countenance you saying, I won't eat matzah at the Seder, you therefore cannot also have it apply to eating matzah at the Seder because it is not a neutral category, right? Lav kehen here is a way of saying, is this a neutral category that you happen to pick one direction on? That's the kind of thing that the Torah kind of empowers and supercharges your oath to be one of its mitzvot. But a category that's not neutral, it cannot apply in the positive direction if it can't apply in the negative direction. On some level, that's a fancy and technical way of saying, according to the Chachamim here, the majority position here, the way they're solving this issue of autonomy within a heteronomous system is, essentially, you find all the topics that the Torah has anything to say about, those are a heteronomous zone. If you can find the parts of life that have no connection to any of the things that the Torah cares about, sure, then there's no signal interference and you can weigh it. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira is just saying, don't do anything that directly contradicts the Torah, but anything that even reinforces it can build on top of it. Yeah.
I'm wondering how the phrase Gadol HaMitzvot Oseh plays into this. It just seemed to me that there's some of it's going on here, but I'm not sure how to work it in.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure if there's like a one-to-one mapping there. The notion of Gadol HaMitzvot Oseh to the taken to a certain extreme, you know, feels like the act of doing something by command is like wholly unlike, right? Doing it in an optional, sorry, yes, WH, wholly different than doing it on a voluntaristic basis. And if you read, you know, sort of in that direction, that's a little bit behind the Chachamim's thinking. Like, these are two completely non-analogous categories. Now, of course, Gadol is more scalar, right, than it is actually saying that these things are totally different. But, yeah, the question of where is the voluntaristic fitting in with the obligatory is the common, like, the common threat. Other thoughts on this Midrash Halakha. This is the sort of fundamental move that lays the groundwork for saying, yes, there's that seemingly untamed possibility of applying your own values, but don't get too excited in that it can't really interfere with anything that God has already weighed in on, okay? It's not like the Torah is saying, well, if you take an oath that you won't circumcise your kids, like then the Torah actually doesn't allow you to do it, like you have to live up to that. Right? It's like, no, that doesn't work. And that's being saved essentially primarily through the language of lehara or leheti. Instead of reading that in the pshat sense of the Torah of anything, it's no. Vayikra he is limited to a very specific set of human activities that are Torah neutral. Okay? And the majority, non-Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, opinion is not just the specific action you're talking about are we neutral on, but the whole cat. Okay? And so therefore, to be clear, according to the main position here, if I take an oath that I will eat in a sukkah, that is a shvuat shav. That is an oath in vain. I did take an oath. I have consequences for that oath, right? But it does not apply as a shvuat bitui to that action. This also, Vincent, like I want to think about it more, but that's the fact that the system has a shvuat shav, which is the way you hold people accountable for kind of irresponsibly taking God's name, and a shvuat bitui, where we say, you better comply, suggests that shvuat bitui is not just about scaring people away from taking God's name in vain. There's like a channel there that has some religious value. And when we determine that it has zero religious value, so then what happens is we're sort of back in the category of, hey, you shouldn't have said that, right? But it has no impact.
Can you give another example?
Another example for which, what kind of case?
Where the vow applies.
Where the vow applies? Yeah, other than like going to the gym. I mean, anything, like anything you want. You could be like, I'm going to take a vow. Again, there's all the, essentially, we're going to leave Rabbi Yehuda ben Beterah behind now. Like if it's about mitzvot, it doesn't apply. But anything that the Torah does not weigh in on is fair game. So I take an oath, I am going to be off my phone for 6 days. Okay, I'm actually going to go off of it for a full week. You do that, the Torah would say, that's now mitzvah de'oraita. And if you then go on your phone, you're chayav to bring a korban. Right? But literally, it's like anything. Right? This is what I'm trying to get us to confront. Anything the Torah is neutral about. It can be, I'm going to play golf with my friend. Right? That becomes a mitzvah de'oraita. Yeah.
And I think one thing that's going on with a lot of oaths in general, it's a person trying to sort of exert control over something, you know, it's a sort of act of mastery, right? Whether it's like, I'm going to, you know, oath about my going to the gym to control my yetzer, or like Lady Macbeth, right? Like I shall birth only man children or something like that, right? It's like, it's not a thing that you can do, but it's some sort of controlling act. And there's something here where it's like, as soon as that verbal domain of humans trying to sort of exert like presumptuous control over the world through our will bumps into the Torah, it's like they want to sort of declare that like a no-go zone, right? Mm-hmm. Like we can't let that sort of like arrogant or whatever like power thing get near this.
100%. Okay, so and look, just to see it manifested again in terms of the consequences in Mishnah Shvuot, when they're listing the various things that count as a shvuat shav, okay, just an oath in vain, which can include things like, I swear that 2 + 2 = 5. Okay, that's a shvuat shav. Okay, it's false. I took the oath, etc. Ezeh shvuat shav, nishba levatel et hamitzvah. If you take an oath not to fulfill a mitzvah, for instance, shelo lasot sukkah, v'shelo litol lulav, v'shelo la'aniach tefillin, you're not going to do any of those mitzvot, zohi shvuat shav, when you deliberately take a false oath, you get makot, that is to say, it's violating a core principle in the Torah, right? Yeah, consuming a forbidden animal in the Torah gets makot in the rabbinic system. Taking a false oath gets makot. What's the line in the Torah that forbids it? Lo tisa, shem Hashem Elokecha l'shav. Don't take God's name in vain. You violate that, it's violating a law in the Torah. And so if you do it deliberately, you get makot. If you do it accidentally, you don't realize then you're exempt. There's no consequences. But note, there's no korban. There's no sacrifice that you bring, because that's only for failing to fulfill a shvuat bitui, an actual commitment of action under the rubric of Vayikra Hey, where you are expected to do the action and then, or to refrain from the action. And if you fail to, then you bring a korban, right? This is the category of shvuat shav. And you see from this that the Mishnah holds like the view we saw in the Midrash. You take an oath, a shvuat bitui, as it were, that is interfering with a mitzvah, that's not an oath at all. You did still take God's name, / make an oath, so you're responsible for doing that. But that's just because basically you did something that was meaningless invoking God's name. Okay? So that's the bottom line. Very simple. And it's very simple until you get to this Yerushalmi. We got an amazing case. Shvu'ah shelo ochal matzah. Asur lochal matzah b'leilei ha-pesach. Shelo ochal matzah b'leilei ha-pesach loke ve'ochel matzah. Someone takes an oath, I will not eat matzah. They may not eat matzah at the Seder. Someone takes an oath, I won't eat matzah at the Seder. They incur lashes. They violated something in the Torah. And they eat matzah at the Seder. Case two. Shelo eshev batzel, asur leshev batzel sukkah. Shelo eshev batzel sukkah, lokev yoshev batzel sukkah. Someone takes an oath, I will never sit in the shade. They are not allowed to sit in a sukkah. They take an oath, I won't sit in the shade of a sukkah. They violated a biblical prohibition. They get lashes. But they go ahead and sit in a sukkah. Let's just first get clear technically. So what are they violating? What are the lashes for? Like what's technically happening with the different categories that we've explored? And then we'll get to what's the idea. The person has made what they attempt to be a shvuat bitui. Right? I will not do X, which is one of the things you can do. So what happens in the different cases?
The explicit mention of the holidays. It's like Pesach and Sukkot, then it's a Shavuot Shav. But if it's all year round, it includes Pesach and Shavuot.
Okay, good. So we'll get to making sense of the why in a minute, but just to be clear, yeah, you want to add to this?
The only content of the first oath is to transgress the mitzvah. Whereas in the second one, you're doing a more generic.
Yeah, the other way. The first, you flipped it, right? In other words, there's 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B. One is matzah, two is sukkah. 1A is, I hate matzah. I'm making an oath I will never eat it again. Okay, we'll come back to the why in a minute. But the what is, that takes hold. That's a shvuat bitui. You are bound by it. You are forbidden from eating matzah.
To become gluten-free.
You can't eat matzah at the Seder. Exactly. Exactly. You are forbidden from eating matzah at the Seder. Okay? However, if you say, I'm taking an oath not to eat matzah at the Seder, why are you loke? Because it's a shvuat shav now. Because this kind of oath cannot take effect when applied to a mitzvah. And that's what you've done. You've applied it to a mitzvah. And therefore, the oath is null and void. You got consequences for that. But ochel matzah, because the oath is null and void. It never took effect. Same thing with sukkah. A generalized self-imposed prohibition on sitting in the shade. That's a shvuat bitui. It takes effect. Therefore, you're not allowed ever to sit in the shade, including on sukkah. However, if you do it, I will not sit in the shade of a sukkah. Again, it's a shvuat shav. Vain, doesn't take effect, consequences for that, but you go ahead and sit in a sukkah. Yeah.
Is the punishment for the shvuat shav different than taking God's name in vain?
It's the main form of taking God's name in vain, and therefore you get malkot, you just get lashes like you would with any garden variety prohibition. The main thing is it's a different consequence from failing to fulfill a shvuat bitui. Failing to fulfill an oath of, you know, intent to act or refrain from action where it's in a neutral zone, then you have to bring a sacrifice. Okay? Now, let's zero in on the why. Because what do you mean? This isn't a neutral zone. Like, the Torah cares about people sitting in the shade. Like, so how can you take an oath, I'll never sit in the shade, and have it take effect? Or I'll give you gave gluten-free. I'll give you another example. Someone who takes an oath, I will never wear leather. According to this Yerushalmi, it is forbidden to them for them to wear tefillin. Which is allowed. Forbidden. We'll get back to what's the role of this Yerushalmi in later halacha. Okay, but just right now, just look at this. That's clear. This Yerushalmi would say, you came there, like, I have a person, my congregation, they took an oath not to wear leather. What do I do about tefillin? The Yerushalmi would say, they're not allowed to wear tefillin. We can talk about what else you do with them, but like that, they're not allowed. There's nothing I can do. Okay? Why? What is that about? How do you process that? Like, what would that even mean?
I wonder if this is sort of like, it shifts your category from somebody who, like, so for example, who was born without a foreskin, right? You can't circumcise somebody without a foreskin, right? If it shifts your category from somebody who has the capacity to somebody who does not have the capacity to fulfill a particular.
Yeah, so that I think could be helpful for understanding, like, why they are exempt or we can't expect it of them. But this is saying more than that. Like, someone, according to this Yerushalmi, someone who takes an oath that they will never wear leather and then puts on tefillin has violated a lav de'oraita and must bring a korban. Okay? Which is not, you're not able, right? There's something actually much stronger going on there. There is now, it is an isur de'oraita for that person to put on tefillin. Leave aside for a minute, we're going to come back to, do we like that we got in this place in the first place? Are you allowed? The Yerushalmi is not necessarily weighing in on the question of whether you're allowed to take an oath like this. That's a really fascinating question about this text. But it just taking it as a given. If someone sits, right, where do they sit? There is no question, according to this Yerushalmi, the person who took an oath never wear leather. It is worse for them to put on tefillin than not to put on tefillin. That's clear, okay? If you could have counseled them before, would you have caught them and not got... Sure, let's pause it for now. The Yerushalmi thinks it's terrible they took this oath, okay? But they did. But I'm still just trying to understand, how is this compatible with earlier Midrash that seemed to say you can't take oaths that impinge?
Yeah.
So how do we resolve it? Yeah?
I mean, I think maybe you would say something like, look, we want to know if you're really talking about the mitzvah or if you're talking about other things that are like mitzvah adjacent, like matzah or hut outside or your jacket or other things. And so like recognizing that like in human speech, sometimes like we really are talking about like, you know, that like human speech is weird. And some, I mean, this comes up in oath stuff, you know, like that sometimes we may be specifying something and sometimes we might be going in a more general direction. And it's almost like this Yerushalmi is looking at these sort of really extreme cases to say like, look, like we recognize there's a distinction that can play out with what your speech signifies about maybe your intent or what we say your intent is based on your speech. So like, this is like a rider on that. It kind of limits that.
Good. But let's just sharpen to be clear with the right. case. This text though is not saying, it could have said, when you said, I swear not to sit in the shade.
Yeah, but we know you didn't mean a
sukkah. This text is saying, you did mean that,
right.
but you meant a bunch of other things too.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Most of the time, it is not a mitzvah to eat matzah or to sit in the shade. And so it might be that the, all of these examples that we've been talking about are kind of like classic mitzvot aseh shehazman gramat. They like they have little narrow windows of the time when they're commanded. And it might be that because most of the time eating unleavened bread or sitting in the shade is actually religiously neutral and is neither forbidden nor commanded by the Torah, that allows the general oath to take effect, whereas mitzvot that are, you know, nohagot all times and moments, whether the rabbinic literature recognizes such or not, it might be that it's impossible to, those kind of like state of being mitzvot, believing in God, whatever, that it might be impossible to take an oath against those in a similar way that it is apparently, at least according to this Yerushalmi, possible to take an oath on Sukkah and Matzah.
Okay, want to add another? Yeah.
I think the rationale may be that the person who says, I'm not going to eat Matzah or not sit in the Sukkah is rebelling against the covenant, is doing it Leachis. There's no other way that I can imagine someone, whereas the person we were talking before with Joshua, Like, if I decide to become a vegetarian, let's assume that there's a mitzvah to eat meat on Shabbat.
Yeah. Or the Korban Pesach.
Yeah, I'm not doing it le'achis. I'm not rebelling against Shabbat. I'm making a general decision about my life that will have a consequence in the fulfilling of one mitzvah.
Good.
Which is very different than rebelling.
Good. So I think this is right. Just to combine these two comments, okay? Right? It's like, on a, whether or not it's limited to the things of time, what you just sort of pointed out is, the way I would say the Yerushalmi thinks about this, and on some level, its interpretation of the Sifra that we saw earlier is, Nishba levatel et ha-mitzvah is when it is a laser-guided attack on a mitzvah. The second, it covers neutral space in its scope, the oath that you're doing. As long as, it's like if you imagine, I'm bored here, I could draw it. It's like, imagine you draw sort of like a circle that represents the area of the Torah's concern. Okay? So the Sifra is saying, you can't have a carve-out smaller circle in that circle of your thing. It has to basically be outside the circle. And the Yerushalmi is saying, no, but what we really mean is, it can't be entirely within the circle. As long as your area of autonomous carve-out extends beyond the circle, then it counts. And then I think the religious anthropological explanation is what you said, which is what we're really after is curbing a person's autonomy when it is used as a tool for destroying other parts of the Torah from within in a rebellious fashion. But what's startling about this Yerushalmi is, at least b'diavad, at least after the fact, it essentially seems to say, look, and this I want to make this Yerushalmi sound less radical than perhaps at first it seems. It says, look, the Torah, in an unforced error, without me telling it what to do, decided to attach to the autonomous zone the consequence of a mitzvah lo ta'aseh with a korban that has to be brought in the mikdash. And apparently that means that sometimes, as long as it's not a direct rebellion, can trump certain parts of the Torah that don't have any such consequences attached to them. At the end of the day, it's as if the Yerushalmi reads the Torah as saying, it's very important to me that you put on tefillin. If it turns out you have a commitment that catches in its dragnet tefillin as one of a million things that you don't put on, I'm not holding you to that mitzvah. Okay? Now, again, what is very unclear here, and if you forced me, I would say, yeah, come on, I think the Yerushalmi would frown on this, is does the Yerushalmi again say, and no problem, go out and take a shvuah like that? We just don't know. Forced to confront it, I would say, I think the Yerushalmi would be opposed, just my sense of like the gestalt of like how rabbinic literature thinks about this. But the bidiyavad picture we have to understand, and we have to take seriously, the Yerushalmi's argument here is that at the end of the day, whether I like it or not, someone who took on that level of commitment, the proper interpretation of the Torah is that the mitzvah aseh yields to the shvuah, as long as the shvuah was not a deliberate, direct attack on the mitzvah. Yeah.
But you could, the bottom line, you know, you read Masechet Nedarim, and it's funny because although it's about the vows, it's about how you, and you know, you disavow the vow, you may read the Yerushalmi as a way of another reason why vows are wrong. It's like it's like frowning on the thing, you can claim, another reason why you shouldn't go this way is because you can create a situation by which you are putting matzah and sukkah and tefillin and whatever else in a place where you don't have to fulfill them. So,
right, it could be. Those words are absent from the Yerushalmi's treatment of it. And you can say, but it should be obvious by genre where they're heading, right? You know, I will say, we'll see later what it looks like for a source to say that. They know about, right? Chazal know about and endorse, you could say create, but certainly are on the side of, you can release vows. And there, I would just say again, that makes it all the more striking. Like, you easily could have, within a rabbinic mentality, You see it. You see they have the notion of nishba levatelat mitzvah is out, right? They have no problem being like, even though you said you were going to do that, we cancel that. Why go this route unless you really believe that's the effect it has? Like, you want to talk about unforced errors? No one forced the Yerushalmi to say that. Like, it easily could have read nishba levatelat mitzvah, aseba lav kehen. This is not neutral, so forget it. It can't happen. I think my suggested reading is whatever the Yerushalmi thinks lechatchila and how we should guide people, they are playing out here their best and deepest understanding of looking deep into Vayikra Hey and saying, what does this tell me about what the Torah cares about? And this is where I come back to like my formulation, which maybe seemed a little over the top at the beginning of it's the Torah endorsing what's important to you. I don't know how this text otherwise gets, you know, derived without some kind of attitude like that. But I hear you. I hear you. Okay, one more comment here, and then we'll go to the harder case.
Okay. So this might not, I was just sort of thinking about this as you were talking, and it's not necessarily directly, but so I think this might have repercussions in the conversation about like what do we do instead of kiddushin, like if people are want to do neder. And you know, that's still a very live conversation in a lot of places.
Right.
Like, how does that play out? If not just one person does that, but if we start having lots of people do it.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, for sure. Shvuat wedding ceremonies, as it were, is one place where Shvuat Bitui certainly can theoretically be deployed to create all kinds of conditions on the ground that then have real consequence, right? The Oraita. Whether they're a chiyub skila as opposed to a law, we can get into those gradations. But it creates real biblical level force, right? That is not easily ignored. Yeah, last point.
Sorry, just wanted to take another pass on like a formal level.
Yeah.
You think it might be significant that these are all mitzvot aseh that are being talked about? And so the not fulfilling your vow is a lo ta'aseh. Generally, we say, look, it's better to neglect an aseh than to...
Right, like could I say, I promise to eat chametz every day.
Or chelev or whatever. So it doesn't say that.
Right.
But if you have a conflict between bitul aseh and transgressing a lot aseh, you should be mevatel the aseh.
Yeah, it seems, I don't have a great answer for you. The Yerushalmi doesn't close that loop. I agree with you, it's hard to imagine, right? It would take it to there. Also, we gave chelev and chametz, those are both karet. But chaylev is always forbidden, so that's not going to ever work. You need something that sometimes is innocuous. That's why I said chametz is a good example. But that's an isur karet. Can you think, is there a sometimes prohibition?
By kohen.
It doesn't seem like it should transfer. But also, the Yerushalmi just has this one laconic passage, right? And it's hard fully to know. Okay, good. The Yerushalmi, not clear that it thinks, you know, you are allowed to do this. And more importantly, coming back to what you threw out earlier, but is sort of more serious in the longer run here, Yerushalmi doesn't really get quoted by anyone later. It's not like it doesn't seem like it shows up in, you know, Hilchot Shvuot at a later point in a serious thing. So I can easily say, that was really interesting. But the Bavli or whoever else thinks about it this way, fine. Okay, but now I'm going to give you a bigger problem. What about Derabanan? What about mitzvot derabanan? Let me say it first in its extreme form. How could you possibly say that a mitzvah derabanan takes precedence over a lav deoraita? Because we're talking about a lav. We're not talking about sit there and don't blow shofar on Shabbat and just, you know, passively don't fulfill a mitzvah in the Torah and other things like that. We're saying, we'll see, we'll get to this case in a minute. Okay, we're going to do a bunch of cases. I take a shua bitui that I am not lighting Hanukkah candles. In what possible world are you going to be able to justify to me that you're going to light Hanukkah candles and violate that Isur D'oraita? Now you can, right? That possible world is some world of whole Shua Bitui is never meant to destabilize authority, but you're reading a lot into Vayikra Hey. Like, Vayikra Hey does not know about or care about Hanukkah candles, right? You can supercharge it into Lotasur and get all rabbinic law back into the Torah. Like, you can do that. But I want you just at least to feel the force of the question. Someone could be pretty darn conservative about the application of law and not even go the Yerushalmi, because the Yerushalmi is saying even a Doraita can get wiped out if... Da-da. Or I take a Shavua, I'm not going to daven for the next 2 years until so-and-so, you know, gets released from prison. That's going to be my protest to God. It's like an Isser Doraita for them to daven the Amida. You're actually going to tell them to do that? Or what will be, now let me back off that, what will be the language you will use? Or what kind of language could you use to defend that? Because again, the not here, okay? The core problem is the Torah didn't have to, but chose to say that lehara o lehitiv, with respect to things on which the Torah is neutral, you are allowed to step in, okay? Now, of course, you already hear that. To the extent you want to translate lehara o lehitiv as neutral, the Torah is not neutral about rabbinic law because rabbinic law is just downstream of. But you can feel how, of course, on a formal level, you're still trading off, right, different mitzvot, but more, I think, on a kind of idea-based level, how do we make that all compute? Yeah.
So the way you're framing it is that you end up having kind of this Rabbanan line for the camels that you're not going to fulfill, and the steroid that you won't violate. But if you're looking at it from the outset, and it becomes a Shavuot Shav, then there's no oath there that you are would then have to fulfill.
Yes, but on what basis will it be a Shavuot Shav? That's the question. You can say it should be a Shavuot Shav, but on what basis will it be a Shavuot Shav?
But why? I mean, I know you used kind of the sing-songy, in a way,
yeah,
to dismiss it, but why is that so far-fetched to say that the Torah anticipates...
It's not. I don't want to say it's far-fetched, but I want us to understand... You won't understand the Rosh unless I give you the sing-song. Okay, first case. The Ran, medieval Spain. With regard to what you said, that the man should fulfill his oath with respect to the principle, but not the interest, this is correct. Okay, so what do we have here? We have some kind of oath that someone has taken to repay a loan. Okay, another kind of thing where you can imagine people are like, either they want to make sure they repay it, or the collector wants to say, I don't really trust you to repay this on time, and so someone's taking an oath. But the debts involved are illegally involving interest. Jews didn't always follow the rules on those things, okay? So the person took an oath, okay? And then they basically, someone's coming to Beit Din and trying to figure, well, I took an oath, I would repay this whole thing with the keren and the ribit, with the principal and the interest. So what happens here? Okay, so he says it's correct. You fulfill the oath with respect to the principal, but not the interest. What's the hava mina? It could be that you would think, since this is an illegitimate loan because it has interest, then anything talking about repaying it is an invalid act against the Torah, and therefore the oath has no force and doesn't matter, and even the principle, right? Okay? And there's a notion also in general of, like, if there's an oath with the principle and the ribit, then you lose the principle in other words, if you as the person giving the loan attach interest to a loan, you also lose the principle. Okay? But the idea is the oath, right? Well, you did say you would pay back the principal. You do have to do that. But you then engaged with the question of whether the oath would take hold to violate the mitzvah as well, since perhaps by taking an oath on both the legal principal and the illegal interest, the oath might take hold on the interest as well. This is a kind of Yerushalmi-type thinking, which is to say, well, if I took a loan of $100... and then I said, I swear I will pay you back 110. So maybe we view that as an oath about a legitimate action of repaying 100. And then, though you shouldn't be repaying the 10, but maybe since part of the oath was legitimate, the part of the oath that's questionable also takes effect. That's the questioner wants to know. Mm-hmm. If you were asking whether one would be liable for a guilt offering for failing to perform this oath, that does not concern us in this case. If you were asking whether this is a real shvuat bitui with real biblical consequences of a korban, well, that doesn't matter. Seemingly, both the parameters of the case, but also no one's going to bring a guilt offering in 14th century Spain. But if you were contemplating that a person might violate the prohibition on interest in order to fulfill his oath, since it was a general and encompassing oath, no one would ever say such a thing. God forbid that we would say that one who takes an oath to eat non-kosher meat along with kosher meat should eat them in order to fulfill his vow. All right, in a way, this is playing with what you asked, Vincent, like slightly different parameters. But there's no way that'll happen. Okay, but here we get to the main point. And even in this case where the interest is rabbinic, so there are different kinds of interest, right? If biblical interest is I borrow 100 and I say I'm going to pay you back 110, okay? But rabbinic interest can include things like I'm borrowing 100 apples and I'll repay you 100 apples. Why? Because price of apples will fluctuate, and there is a hidden interest that is involved in simply repaying back. Obviously, that can happen with currency, too, as we think of it today, but they thought of the currency as a fixed thing, okay? And the commodities are the things that are... So this is what somehow, and there's all kinds of variants on that. This is a certain kind of loan where the interest was rabbinic, okay? And so how does that create a problem? I took an oath, shvuat bitui, to repay this money. What's wrong with repaying the money? A rabbinic violation. Shouldn't it be that the Torah's carve out for autonomy means I will violate rabbinic law by paying it, but I will violate biblical law by not paying it, and therefore I should pay it? Says the Ran, we do not obligate him to pay it. Since the sages demand fidelity to their positions, even if upholding them requires passive neglect of biblical requirements. Now, that's just going to the, I'm not going to blow shofar on Shabbat. I'm not going to take the lulav on Shabbat. And a standard thing, just barring that. It's like I know from the Talmud, the rabbis are sometimes willing to say, forego fulfilling, right? Your biblical obligation. But the thing here that's like a little bit of a sleight of hand is the failure to perform here, the shvua, also triggers consequences, right, on some level of violating biblical law. But you see, the Ran is trying to walk the path of, I don't care if it's rabbinic law. Oaths, the autonomous space in the Torah, are not to be used to destabilize the normative system in all of its parts. That's view number one. Let's jump to the Rosh. There's a background Gemara here, just so you understand, which is that a notion that, at least one reading, that wine for Kiddush on Friday night is described as Mushba ve'omed alav mehar Sinai. There's a standing, we've seen that phrase already, there's like a standing covenantal obligation with respect to wine. On Friday night, and this is used to explain what happens. Basically, the question is, what does a nazir do on Friday night? Mm-hmm. Okay? The nazir is forbidden from drinking wine. And there's, in fact, a drasha that says, le'esor yein mitzvah k'yein harishut. Miyayin v'sheichar yazir, the ban on drinking wine for the nazir, includes obligatory wine. By the way, you see here, just in this local space, like Chazal have no problem reading the Torah sometimes as saying, the Torah said, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat l'kadsho, Zachoreu al hayayin, Zichro k'yein levanon, all the ways we get that into that pasuk, said that, but it also said to the Nazir, don't drink wine, and I assume the command to the Nazir not to drink wine overlaps and carves out of this mitzvah, okay?
This is the Yerushalmi. The Nazir and the Kiddush on Shabbat is the case of the Yerushalmi.
That's right. It's quite similar. It doesn't say it here, but you could imagine that this text can tolerate the carve-out of Kiddush because you're forgiving the wine all year. Okay? Okay. So building on that, Here's what the Rosh says. Umasha sha'alta nishbalava tel mitzvah de rabbanan. What if you take an oath to neglect a rabbinic obligation? We know the Sifra said if you take an oath to neglect a biblical obligation, it's null and void. But that's because the Torah is not neutral about it. But what if it's a rabbinic thing that the Rosh is assuming the Torah is neutral about? Kegon, priyat megillah, v'hadlakat ner Chanukah. And to be clear, this is not a Yerushalmi dynamic. This is, I don't know who is in the anti-Purim camp, but if you're in the rabbinic camp of, if I never had to go to Shul on Purim again, I would die happy, and you take a shvua, I will never hear the Megillah again.
So why didn't
Leibovich do that? There you go, okay? Well, because not everyone follows the Rosh, you'll see. So it's just a question so far. Nishbalavatel mitzvah de Rabbanan, kegon kriyat Megillah, v'hadlakat ner Chanukah. Imchala hashvua v'yevatel mitzvah de Rabbanan. So does it take effect? Does it take effect and cancel out the rabbinic mitzvah? Shitalan mehacha. We can resolve it very simply from the following. Miyayin v'shechar yazir lesor yein mitzvah ki yein harishut. The ban on the nazir to consume wine forbids not just the optional drinking of wine, but also the obligatory expected drinking of wine. Yein mitzvah mainihu, what do we mean when we say obligatory wine? Kidusha ve'avdalta. Mushba ve'omed mehar sinaihu. This is the Rabbeinu Tam reading of this Gemara. We're not going to get too deep into it. But the idea is the way the Rosh, his tradition of reading that Gemara, is that that phrase, mushba ve'omed alav mehar sinai, is v'chi mushba ve'omed alav mehar sinai, reads the whole Gemara is actually saying, what, is wine on Friday night a biblical requirement? Of course not. It's a rabbinic requirement, okay? So it downgrades the reading of, the sort of radical reading of the Gemara there. But at base, what it establishes is, Sugya says, a Nazir does not drink wine at Kiddush. Why? Because it's a rabbinic mitzvah. Mi adavar pashut dishvua chal al kol mitzvah derabanan ve'asur la'asota. It is totally clear, said Zerosh, if you take an oath, it applies to every single rabbinic commandment, and you may not do it. V'cheinami la'avor aveira derabanan yekayem shvuato. Here he closes the loop in the other direction. There's a rabbinic prohibition. You take an oath to violate that? You got to violate it.
So I'll do Me'ilat Sandal every day. Would be a...
If you think, right. If right. That, if exactly. You think right. No, you don't even need to do it every day.
Every...
On Yom Kippur.
You can say, you can specify Yom Kippur.
Yes, we left
right.
That. This is not right. About the Yerushalmi, because the Rosh's whole point is the Torah has given you the ammunition
right.
To blow away anything that the Torah is neutral about. By definition, anything to Rabbanan, the Torah is neutral about. Therefore, you can take a direct shot at that thing and wipe it out. Now, the language here is still Shvua Chal. It takes effect. The Rosh is not suggesting people go around and do this. But he is unambiguous in this text. It's a shocking text. He is unambiguous. If you took that up, okay? Your religious obligation at that moment is to wipe out the mitzvah, even the Aveira Derabbanan. Okay. Now, the Ran would go crazy hearing this. Okay? Did, right? Exactly parallel case. But you actually feel here in this debate, so there's perhaps a little bit of a debate, which I think Donnie is pushing us to think about, is there a debate about, like, rabbinic law and authority and where does it fit into the biblical scheme? Like, that's a piece of it. But I also think there's a piece here that is trying to figure out what are the actual parameters of this autonomy, again, in an unforced way, granted by the Torah. And so from a certain perspective, this is scandalous, right? If you're like, but what do you mean? Like, the rabbis are building a whole system. That how can you do this? This is the worst positivistic gameplay to take the whole thing down. From a different perspective, it could be like, I don't know, but didn't Vayikra Hey say God cares on a do-right-a level about things I commit myself to more than any as of yet unspecified rabbinic legislation. Like, that is a read of the Torah, which, sure, the Rosh as an heir of the Chachamim would say, why would you do that? Right? It could be like, right, the sort of gendered sugyot, like in Kibud Avaim, that will be like, well, if your father tells you to do this, your mother tells you to do this, you have to, and they're in conflict, you have to follow your father. Right? You'll have sugyot about that. Okay? So, of course, anyone who wants to, like, promote shalom bayit and this and that will be like, the parents should probably figure out how to not issue conflicting commands. But at the end of the day, you might say, okay, but if I have the problem, right? I need some way of adjudicating it, right? And truth be told, it's like even we who would see past or reassess like that whole gendered solution to it, there's still times people have conflicting, children of divorce have this all the time, like conflicting things from parents. Like, how are you going to do it? You need to give someone an algorithm to get through it. It's not crazy, right? Even if not necessary to say, well, the Torah gave us an algorithm in Vayikra Hey, which is that the stuff you commit yourself into a shua, in fact, overrides the post-biblical pieces. Okay, yeah.
I wonder, is it possible to read the Ron as basically sort of like viewing the rabbinic holding ordinances as a sort of vow, like itself, those are also a kind of vow, so that you're, when he's saying like you can't violate it, it's because you're now having conflicting vows in a certain sense.
So again, this is one of these things. He could have said that. He doesn't say that. Part of the thing that I find the most striking about the Ran is the Ran basically acknowledges that you are violating a biblical command. And he just says, that's what you're supposed to do. Because rabbinic authority and fidelity to that system sometimes tells you, you don't follow the Torah. But that's what he says. He doesn't find a way, because you're right, it would be so much cleaner to find a way to turn it into a shvuah shav. But he basically feels he can't do that. That's where the Ran seems like he disagrees with the Rosh, but he actually agrees with him. He just disagrees with him on policy. But he basically fundamentally agrees with him on how it works. There's not actually a position, because it's harder than you might think, to say that the rabbinic mitzvah intrinsically trumps the biblical one. You can say, that's what we're going to tell people to do. Right? Which may still be radical, but it's more stable. But it's a problem. And this is where I'm saying, I'm looping you back to like why I began this in the first place. There is apparently more weight to Vayikra Hey than we might at first blush think. Yeah.
I don't understand why he's using the example of the Nazir, because one could argue that the Nazir, the Torah explicitly opened that possibility. And that doesn't apply to any mitzvah.
What, is the Rosh using it?
Yeah, the Torah opened the loophole of the Nazir, and it's a glitch of the system, but it's part of the system.
Right, so we went too fast there, because there is a move there where the way the Rosh reads that Gemara is that there is no glitch in the system of the Nazir, because there is no biblically required wine. The only biblically required wine, or there's Yain Mitzvah, but when we talk about Kiddusha and Avdalta, we're talking about basically a rabbinic level problem. And then the Gemara just becomes almost like a transcript of a statement that, yes, the Nazir drinks wine because it's only a rabbinic requirement to drink wine. So he doesn't even have to go as far as what seems like it's the original pshat of that text of the Yain Mitzvah. It's a little confusing there. I should have either added another step or, you know, skipped that step. So I'm sorry if that was a little confusing. But the Rosh's bottom line, built off that Gemara, is I think the Rosh would for sure reject the Yerushalmi. Okay? Like, I don't think there's any reason to think he would accept it. But the Rosh is saying, but if all you're dealing with is a rabbinic command, that gets overridden. Let's see the Bach. This is our final source. And you'll see here the attempt to deal with it. The plain sense of his words, the Rosh, is that if someone took an oath to pay off rabbinically prohibited interest, the oath would take hold, and he would be able to violate this prohibition in order to fulfill his oath for which he would be punished on a biblical level. Mutav sheyase isura zuta mima sheyase isura rabba. Better that he do a small transgression than doing a large one. He's just pointing out, if you apply the Rosh's logic to the Ran's case, he would come out exactly the opposite. And again, actually, I think giving helpful language here, like, at the end of the day, this person has put themselves in a situation where they must transgress. And the question is, which is the worst transgression?
Right.
Okay? And, all right, what am I going to do? It seems to me, now this is the Bach, that the proofs brought by the Rosh would not have escaped the Ran. Meaning, at the end of the day, the Rosh has all his arguments. And the Ran came out differently. So just a classic move of like, the Ran was no idiot. So how did he come out this way? It can't be that the Rosh's argument is watertight. Rather, the Ran thinks that all those passages are dealing with the liability to bring a guilt offering if one violated the oath. Meaning the Ran would think all the passages the Rosh talks about are in the more extended passage are just about the consequences. But God forbid that the court would require someone who took an oath to actively violate the court's rulings. Sure, if he violated their rulings and fulfilled the oath, he would indeed have fulfilled his biblical obligation, given that it was a binding oath. But as a matter of destruction, we don't tell him instruction. We don't tell him to do this. Okay, so just sort of doubling down, he's like, yes, the Ran would agree that it's the worst avera. It's the worst transgression to uphold rabbinic law. But we would nonetheless tell you to do that because it can't be. You actually almost hear the language of, at the end of the day, who's giving instruction on this? Rabbinic courts. How can rabbinic courts give orders to disobey their own orders? Like, it doesn't, that's his argument. It doesn't compute. Rosh would concede to this point. Now here I think he's twisting the words. When the Rosh wrote, and so too, with respect to violating a rabbinic restriction, the last line there, v'chein nami la'avor avera d'rabanan, and it says, yekayem shvuato, the plain sense of which is, fulfill your oath, do the thing, violate the rabbinic thing, he only meant that the oath would take effect with regard to liability for a guilt offer. Meaning, yekayem shvuato, which means, don't violate it, don't violate the rabbinic law, thereby violate the biblical law and understand you're liable for a korban. Okay, that I think is a total distortion of what the Rosh is saying. But you see, the Bach is scandalized by the conclusion, knows the Ran doesn't go that way, and is trying to bring the Rosh into compliance. But here's cutting the Gordian knot. I then found that the Marshal wrote about this response of the Rosh, none of our other masters agree with him on this point. Rather, we force him to get the vow released. That is the correct view. Okay? Now there, so this goes back to what I was saying earlier. There you see the Marshal talking in the language you would sort of expect, and some of you were trying to retroject onto the earlier time. No, this means it's terrible. Like, find a way out of it. But this is what it looks like to actually say it. The Marshal is saying we are absolutely not going to have this situation. But note, even the Marshal agrees what? It's a valid oath, you got to release it.
All right.
No one can actually fully escape the vortex of the fact that Vayikra Hey opens up this wormhole in at least rabbinic law, if not something larger in the Torah, as we see in the Yerushalmi. Now, closing it out here, what do you do with this, right? So at the end of the day, it's like temperamentally, dispositionally, all of this, like I'm totally with the Marshal, right? It's like, yes, don't do that, etc. Like, no. You may not all be, but that's where I am. I would be like, no, we're not going to use this in all kinds of sophisticated ways to get around X, Y, and Z rabbinic law. I also don't think of in general like halachot as things we're like trying to get around in that way. It's like, what are they about? How do they apply? Et cetera, et cetera. But I do, and we have a couple minutes just for final thoughts on this, I do find this like potentially like very helpful for me to have language, both the Yerushalmi, but also some of this, for people who present themselves as already being in that kind of space of conflict. Okay, that is to say, someone who comes forward, forget about whether they've actually taken a shvua that's at that level or what I would consult them to do. Someone who's like, I really don't wear leather. And they're like, what do I do about tefillin? Even if at the end of the day, I would have a whole conversation with them about, well, you could make tefillin out of animals that have died naturally, and it's harder to find them, but you can try to find them on the market, and let's talk it through and all of that. And I would see my role in a kind of rabbinic halachic guidance capacity to push towards maximal compliance integration. I think these texts do say something powerful about kind of understanding from that person's internal perspective of how they are not necessarily like rebelling against the Torah, or, you know, just having a thing of like, well, I don't feel like, you know, doing this, so I'm not going to. But actually both potentially for my own understanding, but maybe even in a way that's like helpful for someone in that position, could you actually potentially reframe your autonomous desire here to behave in X, Y, and Z way as somehow folded into some larger framework of the Torah that includes Vayikra Hey? And whether or not I think you should make a commitment that locks you out of putting on tefillin or locks you out of eating matzah at the Seder, obviously the gluten-free stuff is often wrapped up in health, so that's a whole other thing. But nonetheless, like, I think there's something potentially powerful and generative about recasting and potentially rechanneling instincts and questions like that back into, again, the framework of the Torah itself that in an unforced way it kind of puts forward.